I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Scott Douglas. He's Executive Director of the Greater Birmingham Ministries, and he's on the steering committee of the Alabama Coalition for Immigrant Justice. And he will be in New Mexico this Friday for a community dialogue, and we'll hear more details about that at the end of the show. Scott Douglas, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So here we are in New Mexico dealing with the ongoing effort of the governor of New Mexico to get the legislature to repeal the immigrant driver's license law. You have witnessed the passage of the Alabama immigration law, HB 56, which has a lot of provisions in it about what the police can do, things that have to do with college and schooling, transportation, employment, documents, and so on. And some of the provisions have been blocked. Most of them stand. It's the toughest immigration law in the nation. How did this law get passed? What were the political forces that caused this bill to be introduced and then passed by the Alabama legislature?
Thank you. First of all, you have to recall that in November 2010, the same year that the Republicans took over a majority in the United States House of Representatives, largely driven by the Tea Party movement, that movement also drove the Alabama state elections, making Alabama a majority Republican in its House and its Senate for the first time in 136 years. So for the first time in a very long time, we have a Republican governor, a Republican Senate, and a Republican majority House. Now, to be sure, Alabama Republicans had historically been fiscal conservatives and social conservatives in a long-standing Alabama tradition. But this Tea Party wing elected to the legislature and to the House, to the Senate and the House, a lot of people who had no previous governing experience, who came there on a very narrow set of agendas to prove a point, I guess. And it was that new majority that passed these this HB 56 with very little debate and only two public hearings. They literally had a supermajority, right, so they could pass any laws they wanted to, and they did.
Right. The thing that I keep looking at and wondering about and thinking about is to what extent movements like this are grassroots movement that originate in the minds and hearts of the people, and to what extent they're really national agendas that are being funneled down into the state legislatures by movements like the American Legislative Exchange Council and national movements like that that have their own agendas.
Well, actually, as you know, the Alabama bill, HB 56, was Arizona's anti-immigrant law on steroids, and it was itself produced by ALEC, the Legislative Exchange Council, whatever ALEC stands for, and it was delivered to Alabama, and quite frankly, you're exactly right. We're passing laws that didn't originate out of the expressed and articulated needs of Alabamians, but instead owe their origin to outside forces pushing a wide-scale shotgun approach, national legislation, state legislature by state legislature. While there's concern about immigration in many states, Alabama is not a border state, and as a matter of fact, the official estimate of undocumented immigrants in Alabama is only 2.5%.
So it's not like there was, in Arizona, we can talk, and in New Mexico too, we can talk forever and a day about border issues and so on, but this was basically a non-problem that still produced a law because of this ALEC and because of the conservative forces who were really working on a national level. Why Alabama? Was it because of this Republican supermajority? They just thought, well, that's a place we can get it through?
Well, actually, there are several bills got passed that session, including, for instance, some anti-public employee, anti-teacher laws, very similar to Wisconsin. It's the same session that passed HB 56. So a national agenda got passed in that legislature, including HB 56. And mostly these were laws that appeals to the passions of uninformed people, the fears of people, the made-up fears of people, and in order to make the legislators look like they were doing something, and at the same time they were ignoring pressing issues facing the state of Alabama, like unemployment, like education funding, two areas in which they did nothing. To show you how much they tried to fool people, the name of this bill, HB 56, the official name is the Alabama Taxpayer Protection and Job Creation Act.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Well, what has been the effect of this law in Alabama since it was passed last year?
The most immediate effect was to spread terror among immigrant families, documented and undocumented. As you may well know, families often have multiple levels of document status. Some are documented, some are not. So intact families at first began to flee the state. We talked to one family that said they were leaving, and we told them, wait, you know, there's going to be a fight back against this law. And they said in response, quote, we don't want to live where people hate us, unquote. There was problems of parents who may be undocumented, but their children were born here and they're citizens, worried about being, you know, detained on the way to work, put in detention, never see their children again. So people often fled in order to keep their families intact. So the immediate effect was terror, fear. But immediately organizations began to move. Lawsuits were filed against this law, and information being passed out to immigrants, families, and communities, letting them know what their rights still were, that a fight back was going on, and that not to act hastily, to put it in the best way, don't act hastily in terms of fleeing the state.
Now, we have heard reports about farm workers. A lot of farm workers did leave the state, and that has had quite an effect on farming in Alabama.
Oh, very much so. There's a recent report out by the University of Alabama that estimates agricultural and other economic losses to our register have topped $10.8 billion. This comes from the fact that many crops last summer and spring were left to rot in the fields, and also important winter planting seasons were lost. Of course, Alabama farmers tried everything, including being encouraged to use prisoners. But like Georgia, that experiment failed. You can force prisoners to go through the fields, but you can't force them to be productive in an area of work in which they have no experience.
Well,
so now the farmers are up in arms. Most of them are Republicans, and they're up in arms against HB 56 and are seeking to get changes in the law.
I mean, what's so interesting about this is it brings attention to a lot of things. One of them is how very productive those immigrant workers are. And also, when you talk about $10 billion worth of loss in that agricultural sector, you know that those people who were there picking the crops and planting the crops and so on were terribly underpaid.
Yes, they were. Right. And so how do you make a living on that very low pay? They work tremendously long hours at tremendously productive rates of work, highly productive. But as a matter of fact, we heard one story from Georgia about some immigrants going into the fields to help Georgia's prisoners be more productive with the crop they were trying to harvest.
I know. It's like you want somebody to make a movie about this because people just don't understand what these people's lives are like, either the prisoners or these very hardworking immigrant laborers who, in my view, are being scapegoated in so many ways?
They most certainly are. As a matter of fact, some of the worst horror stories we heard happened even back when the bill was being discussed, but before it was passed. We had some horrible tornadoes here in Alabama April 27th. And on April 28th, someone called in ICE on a immigrant volunteer who was helping a neighbor clean debris from his yard.
Oh, and this person
was picked up and detained from volunteering to help a neighbor.
Oh, my goodness. Some other issues that I think are important to talk about. When there is a climate of fear, people tend not to call the police and report crimes because they're afraid that they'll be reported, such as domestic abuse and things like that. What does that look like in Alabama since the passage of this law?
The information is sketchy. Some of our immigrant rights groups have very active domestic violence counseling arms with them. And part of a KYR campaign, they call it, is called Know Your Rights. That's an effort to get accurate information into families and into communities. And part of that is, by the way, you should know this, a lot of major law enforcement, including here in Birmingham, the police department and the Jefferson County Sheriff's, are not paying any attention whatsoever to HB 56. They have gone on radio and TV publicly denouncing the law, and on top of that, they're saying that exactly what you said. It took them, you know, some time to build up trust and confidence in the immigrant community, and this HB 56 was threatening to break that in terms of reporting of crimes and the reporting of abuse. So at least here in Jefferson County, the largest county in the state, we have, and we've been monitoring this as well, the cooperation of the sheriffs and the Birmingham Police Department. At the same time, in smaller towns, it's gone completely amok. Not just police departments, but even there was a store, Walmart, in North Alabama, where the checkout cashier suspected somebody of being undocumented and asked for proof of citizenship at the checkout counter.
That is not required
by the law. So a lot of vigilante types at the ground level in this atmosphere of legalized fear and terror make up laws as they go, further endangering people and actually reducing the humanity of folks.
We're talking to Scott Douglas of the Greater Birmingham Ministries, who will be here this coming Friday in Santa Fe. How are these struggles that immigrants are facing and even documented immigrants are affected by this law, how are these struggles similar to and different from those that African Americans have been facing in this country all along?
Well, the similarities are that in a majority white state, it's fairly easy for someone to pick you out of a crowd and apply unjust laws to you. Jim Crow segregation was about separation of the races in every area, from housing to employment to education. So in the terms of forced separation, it's very similar. It's dissimilar in this sense that, back in the 1850s during slavery, they had what they called the Fugitive Slave Acts, where it was against the law for anybody to assist a slave trying to escape slavery and find freedom.
Right.
Well, HB 56 is like the Fugitive Slave Act in reverse. HB 56 made it illegal for anyone to assist an immigrant just for being here. So the Fugitive Slave Acts caught you going, and HB 56 catches you coming. That's kind of perverse irony, a reversal, but it's the same way, identifying people for extra punishment. And I don't mean to, someone said this is over the top, but quite frankly, the authors of the bill said they wanted people to self-deport, quote, self-deport, make life so unbearable they would self-deport. Now, that never applied to slavery. But self-deport is something like ethnic cleansing, and we feel it has to be stopped.
How did you get involved in this issue?
Well, I work for a faith-based organization that serves low-income families, and among our family we serve are low-income whites, African-Americans, and immigrants. And this law does two things just directly to us. First of all, it made it illegal for us. No, the law would require my organization, Greater Birmingham Ministries, to check the citizenship of everybody we assist with free food, clothing, and utility assistance. Now, the only documentation we require is proof of need. Like, show us you need help with rent. Show us you need clothing. Show us you need, food. That's pretty easy to do. That's all. So they would force us to do extra documentation. We're not going to do that. We're a faith-based organization, and we're called to serve based on one condition, and that's need. Secondly, it affected us because, as Dr. King said, injustice to anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So African-Americans who have trod the bloody soil of our struggles, I'm African-American, our organization is multiracial, but we certainly cannot stand by and idly by while others who don't necessarily look like us have their human rights trod upon.
I've been thinking about how laws like this put people who are completely unqualified into the position of checking immigration status. If you know about how many different immigration statuses there are and how many different kinds of letters there are, and it's not just a green card, there's so many kinds of visas that you have to be trained to do that, and yet they're expecting everybody to just do it.
The Alabama State Attorney General, who supports the law, has, sometime after the law got passed, requests from law enforcement all around the state begging for training on how to enforce the law. They did not know how to do it then, and most don't know how to do it now. As you well know, it was Alabama who caught what? We got three big car plants here, a Japanese executive, a Korean executive, and a German executive from Mercedes-Benz caught up in HB 56.
Right. The German executive was arrested because he had left his passport. He was a Mercedes-Benz executive, left his passport in his hotel room.
Right. These people, we have school kids. School kid who was bullied about, did he have a green card? Another kid, and the kid said, no, I do not. Well, it turns out the kid is Puerto Rican. He's a U.S. citizen.
Right. So when you look at this issue and you look at what's going on, in the history of Alabama, I think about the kind of racism that was brought to the nation's attention in the 1960s when Dr. Martin Luther King and his supporters were doing peaceful protests in Alabama, and there's all these images that are still engraved in our minds, whether we were even born there or not, of fire hoses and police dogs and that kind of seething hatred against African Americans. And to what extent does that mentality, that kind of, I don't know what to call it, old inbred racism, how much does that play a role in this?
Well, it plays a very big overarching role. Remember the slogan that came out right after Obama was elected president among the Tea Party? We want our country back.
Right.
The "we want our country back" is thinly coded language. We want our white country back. We want a sense of white privilege that is validated and justified back. Enough of civil rights already, enough of tolerance already. That's what we see in the slogan, "We want our country back." But we side with those who say, well, you're not taking us back. The whole country, quite frankly, needs to move forward. And we forget that we are a nation of immigrants.
Well, exactly. When you think about the hazing ritual that every single immigrant group, from Irish to Italian, I'm Italian, Germans, every group has been put through before they get to assimilate and take their place, it becomes kind of ludicrous. The same kind of language that they're using against Hispanic immigrants right now, they were using in the 18th century against other European groups.
Oh, yes, and that happened right here in Birmingham, but people forget. As a matter of fact, as early as recently as the 1920s, Greeks and Italians were classified as black in Birmingham.
Right.
And were forced to live in the same neighborhoods by law.
So what can be gained, and how much do you see of a connection between the African-American community and the immigrant community? Are you coming together in Alabama around this issue of civil rights?
Very much so. I think we're a little late because we began building these bridges proactively after the bill was passed. And I wish we had gotten started before the bill was passed in an organized,
right,
systematic way. And that's very important to do that anyway. But like just back in June 25th, we had a march of 4,000 people in the streets of Birmingham, a silent prayer candlelight vigil, but 4,000 people attended. All the way up until December, we had another 4,000 people in and outside of, most outside, the historic 16th Street Baptist Church, where Congressman Luis Gutierrez and others came with messages of unity and solidarity, black, white, and brown, against HB 56 and other such laws. The solidarity, the collaborative struggle is building, and still have a lot more to do. And some of it is just geographical. Some of the highest concentrations of immigrants are in the poultry processing areas of northern Alabama, where there are few African Americans, and not nearly as much in the cities. But we also learn how to bridge that gap too.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you think about it in terms of who's being exploited, whose work is being exploited, I mean, African Americans' work have always been exploited since slavery and to the present day, and immigrants work the same thing, and you'd think that they'd be natural allies, but there tends to be a kind of either, you call it divide and conquer, or sort of a competitive atmosphere at the lower levels of the totem pole in society.
Quite frankly, like one of the roles I do play in terms of African American churches is speaking at and speaking with African American congregations about what our role is in this as part of the unfinished business of civil and human rights in Alabama and in this country. Unfortunately, Birmingham has fallen back to celebrating 1960s as if that was a battle that was completed and over. It's not. So, but inside the African community, that's what I call secondhand bigotry, a hand-me-down bigotry, in which I found African Americans mouthing the same anti-immigrant stereotypes that's mouthed in the white communities, based on nothing. I've been told to my face, Scott, you got to stop this. You got to put black people first. And I say, well, what part of the message of Dr. Martin Luther King did you not get? You know,
exactly.
So it's time for us African Americans to stop honoring Dr. King on his birthday and start honoring him in our lives. The Poor People's March, that his last big campaign during which he was assassinated, was about bringing Appalachian whites and Delta, Mississippi and Alabama African Americans and migrant farm workers at that time to Washington, D.C. to build a tent city to put the economic agenda of poor people in the United States on the national agenda. That's what the Poor People's Campaign was about. That's what Martin Luther King was about. That's what we're about.
So why are you coming to New Mexico this Friday?
I was invited not because I'm an expert on what's going on in New Mexico, but just to share our experiences here in Birmingham and in the state of Alabama in forging alliances and building solidarity across lines of color and ethnicity in pursuit of a shared justice, what danger happens to a state when a fear-based national anti-human template is imposed on the state independent of what the state's needs are, and how we tried to build commitment to bring people together across other boundaries to fight it.
Scott Douglas is executive director of Greater Birmingham Ministries, and he also works with the Alabama Coalition for Immigrant Justice. And he will be in New Mexico this Friday for a community dialogue called Resisting the Politics of Fear, the connection between anti-immigrant laws and the struggle for civil rights. That's this Friday, the 10th of February, from 5 to 7 at the Hotel Santa Fe. In addition, he will be speaking on Friday morning in the Capitol Rotunda at the State House here in the capital of New Mexico, and that's part of African American Day, and he will be there along with Arizona State Senator Steve Gallardo, who we'll be talking to a little bit later this week, and Rachel Terran from Promise Arizona and Professor Christina Sierra from UNM, and that's from 10 to 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday, sponsored by the NAACP and Somos un Pueblo Unido. And by the way, you were on the Colbert Report the other night, which I happened to catch the night that it aired.
Oh, yes. That's the best way to find old high school classmates. But yeah, but it was enjoyable. I was extremely nervous. I'm glad it's over. We were invited, and we thought about it and decided to go. And we think it was helpful in getting the Alabama story out.
Well, we look forward to seeing you this Friday here in Santa Fe. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I look forward to being there.
For more information on Friday's event, you can call Somos Un Pueblo Unido at 424-7832 or go to somosunpueblounido.org. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome to the program Ian Chaney. He's a filmmaker. His new documentary is called The City Dark, and it opens on Friday, the 10th of February, here at the CCA in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So this is a film about the extraordinary amount of light that we've put into the world over the last 100-plus years through electric light. How did you come to make this film?
Well, after moving to New York City, I came to feel that there was something really missing from my life, which is a surprising thing to feel when living in New York, because there's so much to do and see. But I came to realize that I was missing the stars, missing the night sky. I grew up something of an amateur astronomer, spending a lot of time in rural Maine. And that feeling set me wondering what it means that most of us now in the world, over half the world's population, live in cities, brightly lit cities, where we don't have any connection at all most nights to the night sky. And that launched this journey to understand how artificial light affects us and the rest of the species we share the planet with.
The film walks a really nice line between science and more what you might call humanistic perspectives on what is really, in so many cities, the disappearance or the virtual disappearance of the dark night. And one thing that was fascinating to me was, I mean, I thought about this, and we've talked about this on the radio, when you spend time in nature, you kind of remember that human beings are not the center of the universe when you spend time in the forest and so on. And it's the same thing when you look at the night sky, that you can realize very quickly that you're a tiny part of the greater universe. Why do you think that's so important for us to experience?
It's true that it's tricky to put your finger on why exactly that kind of perspective is so important. I spoke to a number of people over the course of making the film, both on camera, folks I interviewed like Hayden Planetarium director Neil deGrasse Tyson and the co-author of the Cosmos series, Ann Druyan, and off-camera folks I would sit next to on the plane or train or bus and talk to about the meaning of the night sky. And in many ways, I think we all get something different out of what Neil deGrasse Tyson calls that cosmic perspective of realizing our place in the universe. For me, it's at once a reminder of how precious a planet we live on, how unique a place this is, and how foolish we would be to treat it with disregard. And It's also a reminder of how much there is to explore beyond this planet. So it really fires my imagination in exciting ways. And I think for educators and folks who are working with young people, they talk about the night sky as a source of inspiration that can lead kids into careers in science and into careers in astronomy, but also into careers in poetry and in the more, as you called it, humanistic realms. And I think that's very invigorating and exciting. And I think at the end of the day, it's hard to put a price tag on something like that.
Well, it's one of the things I really liked about your film is that it had a poetic quality to it, very much so in the way that you talk to people and in the way that you did the editing and filmmaking and cinematography. It's really quite a beautiful film. And, I mean, on the pure scientific level, I wanted to talk about, there were some things I learned that I had no idea about, and one of them is the connection between working through the night shift work, that and cancer, breast cancer, possibly other types of cancer. What's going on there?
Well, it was one of the more surprising things about making the film. I knew nothing about it when I set out to explore this topic, the idea that exposure to light at night could disrupt our circadian rhythm and essentially disrupt our internal systems to the extent that it weakens our natural defenses. And as a result, could put us at increased risk of certain cancers like breast cancer and prostate cancers and maybe other diseases as well. And while this science is very much evolving in real time, new research is coming out all the time as these chronobiologists and epidemiologists start to understand what different intensities of light affect us and at what time of day and what color of light. It's also very intuitive, the idea that we, like many species on the planet, evolved, for the most part, for a long time, with pretty regular cycles of light and dark, and it's only been very recently, extremely recently in an evolutionary sense, that we've disrupted those rhythms, and we spend a lot of time indoors in half-lit environments, and then at night, instead of being in total darkness, we tend to stay up late or even all night. And so it's in many ways not surprising that we're starting to see the idea emerge that we might be putting ourselves at increased health risks because of the way we light.
And it does make you wonder, and this isn't in the film, but I found myself wondering because one of the questions that keeps coming up in the film is, how adaptable are we really? And so you think of people living in Scandinavia where it's almost dark almost all winter and light almost all summer, and how do their bodies respond to that? But to move on to another question about not people but animals, this was perhaps the most horrifying part of the film for me, and it's a very beautiful film, but the fact that the light of coastal cities is killing tens of thousands of sea turtles a year. What's going on there, and how does that happen?
Well, many species on the planet evolved to use certain signals from nature to proceed through the world, to mate, to hunt, to hide. And in the case of sea turtles, it seems to be the case that sea turtles evolved to find the sea when they hatch. When they hatch, they're tiny, you know, adorable, about the size of a fist, and they pop up out of the sand. And for years, their way of finding the ocean, which they need to find very quickly lest they become dehydrated or fall victim to predators or starve, their way of finding the sea was that it was the brightest horizon. It was starlit. And the shore would have been very extremely dark before artificial light. What's happening now is as coastal cities get brighter and as the sky over those cities gets brighter and brighter, it causes disorientation. And so a significant percentage of baby sea turtles have been essentially heading in the wrong direction, heading to Miami's nightclubs when they should be heading to the starlit seas. And that's on top of all of the other obstacles we're throwing at a species like sea turtles, problems with fishing and polluted waters and development along the beaches. So it's yet another example of the way in which a kind of evolutionary cycle and system has been disrupted in a way that they're struggling to adapt to.
We're talking to Ian Chaney about his documentary, The City Dark. You talk in the film about archetypal meanings of night and darkness versus light and day, and these concepts are imbued with spiritual and intellectual meanings, like the idea of enlightenment, seeing the light, things like that. And a century ago, probably nobody would have guessed that too much light might actually have negative consequences. And I have to say, you know, watching this film, I was thinking about how much I love going out at night and how much I love dancing late into the night at a club and things like that. And at the same time, sometimes I think we should just turn out all the lights at 9 o'clock and go to bed and live with the cycles of nature and so on. Most of us don't want to do that, even if it would be healthier. So there's no sort of clean right and wrong with this whole issue of what some might call light pollution.
Right. And that's in a way what has made it such a fascinating topic for a film. I mean, films are, I think, most interesting when it's not black and white or an issue of right or wrong, when we can actually delve into some of the complexities of an issue like this. And, you know, you could think of it this way. What do we find so beautiful about a starry night sky? It's on the one hand the fact that it's dark outside, but it's also that there's all these beautiful twinkling lights, and maybe that's one reason why I've come to feel a surprising affection for the New York City skyline. Few advocates of quote unquote dark skies, and there's a wonderful organization called the International Dark Sky Association that has been pushing for smarter lighting. Few advocates would suggest that we need to turn off all of our lights. There's so much to be gained from light. We're a diurnal species after all, and there's a lot to be gained from evening entertainment and navigation and security and the rest of it. But there's also a tremendous amount of waste. An enormous amount of the light in our world just heads up into space or splashes where it needn't be. So we have this kind of awesome opportunity to bring back starry night skies, save a lot of energy, and maintain what is wonderful about the way we light our world.
How has making this film and thinking about these issues affected the way that you're living and seeing your own days and nights?
Yeah. Well, I certainly have started sleeping with eye shades and installed blackout curtains over my Brooklyn windows. So clear had it become that light at night might not be doing me any favors, and I'm sleeping a lot better as a result. It's also made me realize that the night sky is very much part of nature. It hasn't tended to be something that we define as being part of the quote-unquote environment, the stars, you know, the night sky. We haven't tended to fold that into the list of things like rivers and forests and oceans that we conserve. And yet, I've come to realize that part of nature is just as important, if not even more important, because it's so often overlooked than the more traditional areas we've come to conserve. So it's made me seek out dark places and even in the city seek out opportunities to lie on a rooftop and do a bit of stargazing with whatever stars we're lucky enough to see up there.
I have to say, I'm not an amateur astronomer by any means, and I only know a half a dozen constellations when I look at them. But I didn't know how well I knew the night sky and how oriented I was toward it until one time I went to South America and the night sky was completely different, and it messed with my head because there was a different sky above me. And I thought, wow, I guess unconsciously I know this sky better than I think.
Yeah, it's true. You could imagine what somebody 150 years ago, anybody, anywhere, would think stumbling into a modern city these days. The night sky for so long has been not only a source of stories and myths and mystery and inspiration for science, but it's been a fixture for how we orient ourselves on the planet. And I worry that this that on top of all of that that we're losing, we might just start to become a more downward-looking species. And on the one hand, there's a lot that needs to be paid attention to here on the planet and in our communities. But I worry what kind of solipsistic effect that might have if we suddenly forget our place in the cosmos and our place in the universe.
Ian Chaney is a filmmaker. His new documentary is called The City Dark, and it opens on Friday, February 10th at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much, Ian, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Nick Gadbois, Rusty Storbeck, and Sally Blakemore. They are all musicians in the band Shona Slovakia, which is playing at El Farol this Saturday from 9 to 12:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So Shona Slovakia, that's a kind of multicultural name right there. What's it all about?
Well, it started in our house, actually. And Rusty and Nick and I had been the core group, and we were like going, what can we name ourselves? And we wanted to keep Shona because we were playing some of that traditional music we've sort of improvised out on. And then we said...
Which is from where?
From Zimbabwe.
So the marimba music.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the Shona part comes
from. And then the other one, we went, where's the farthest place from that we could combine with? And it was Slovakia. So we went, Shona Slovakia. Ha ha ha. But what's happened now, people that are from Slovakia come to our shows. And they say, where is our music?
Yeah. And is it there?
No, we're adding it slowly.
That's hilarious. Now, what does each one of you play? What do you play, Nick?
I play electric guitar, and I sing. I write some of the songs.
And I play the soprano marimba and hosho, which is a shaker, and other percussion instruments.
And Sally?
And I play the African marimba. It's an extended, there's three octaves. A steel drum, a Trinidad steel drum, bongos, percussion instruments, and accordion.
All at one time, no doubt.
All at one time.
So this is it's quite a band, and you do a variety of things, and we're going to go out with a piece of music that I hope contains elements of everything. But how do you, I mean, where do you get your songs? Some of them are covers. Are they all covers?
We do covers now. Nick's written some fabulous songs that we've added. And he's written some ranchera and funk and sort
ska.
Of ska. So we're having a lot of fun with his ideas and adding elements of what we like to do, too. Because the whole band is a democratic band, so everyone takes a solo whenever they can.
Kind of when the spirit moves them?
Exactly.
That's right.
When people ask you to characterize what this is, how do you describe it? I mean, a little bit of everything? Or?
It's dance music from around the world.
Ah, okay.
It's definitely dance music, and another strong element is New Orleans dance music.
Right.
There's quite a few songs with this New Orleans flavor. We do a Professor Longhair song, a couple of them actually, and St. James Infirmary, all this stuff that came, you know, where the African music met America. And it's a good combination.
And it's also just wild, fun fusion, because we do listen to each other. And when someone says something totally new, the whole band goes wild. So we fuse everything with everything else. It's really fun.
On top of all this, you're all artists of one kind or another. Nick is an incredible painter whose work was actually up here in the Santa Fe Baking Company not long ago and who's been exhibited all over the United States. And Sally, you're an incredible illustrator and designer. And Rusty is, among other things, a multilingual person, translator of Russian. Do you bring all that creativity and work into the music somehow?
Yeah, it all happens. You know, I did the cover art on our CD, and then, you know, Sally does all the posters, and she's a constant, relentless promoter, sending out emails.
But I think the dynamics of other arts, like, you know, contrast and composition, all play into it. I mean, we're all just reaching for that edge. And so it's fun to do as a team and not alone.
Well, it's creative, too, because we get to make up our sound, you know, just improvise. And we'll just grab anything. We do a waltz, we just don't care.
But we do mean business.
Yes.
Now, do you have a following of dancers and fans that show up at your gigs?
We do. It's interesting. When we had that big, you know, CD release party, we had about 250 people show up. And then through the year, we played all year last year at Second Street Brewery. And through the year, we had like handfuls of 20 and 30 of that same group showing up. And then we met a lot of different people playing a lot of different venues this year. We played Zozobra, we played Fiesta, we played the Lady of the Guadalupe Festival, which is a treat. And so we've met a whole bunch of diverse groups, from book people that come, you know, handmade book people, to musicians.
You have some New Mexican music incorporated as well as everything else.
There is a song about Socorro I wrote that's on our album there, and about kind of the hard times when I was struggling in Taos in the 70s. And not that I went to Socorro, but it just kind of...
resonated.
Yeah, seemed to find its way into the song.
It's a cool one. I like it.
Yeah, it's one of our dance faves.
And there's two other members of the band, Gerald Rodriguez and Dave Smith, and they will, of course, be with you on Saturday night at El Farol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. El Farol, here we come.
The band is called Shona Slovakia, and they'll be playing at El Farol this Saturday, the 11th of February, from 9 until 12:30 in the morning. Thank you so much for being with us. And how can people get your disc, Shona Slovakia?
Well, you can order it from our website.
Which is?
Which is artywildmaker.org.
Wildmaker.
A-R-T-Y. Artywildmaker.org.
Excellent. I will link to that on my website as
well. Thank you so much.
Nick Gadbois, Rusty Storbeck, and Sally Blakemore, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter at radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.